Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duvin, your host, along with my co-host for this edition, Will Lynn. And today we dive back into Mythosophia. I am very excited, Will, because you now have the website, Mythosophia, up on the internet at mythosophia.com. And yeah, folks can listen to the interviews there, as well as at richarddugan.com. And today we're going to have a very special guest in studio. Tell us who that is.
So today we're going to have Dara Marks. And again, I'll give a real formal introduction when we bring her in. But Dara's a field-leading script-writing consultant. And she also, unlike many of the rest, she has a PhD in mythology. So she brings a real synergy to screenplays, screenwriting, and storytelling, visual storytelling, and myth. And so it seems like a perfect corner to the drum we're trying to tighten for this talk.
I find this, again, very interesting. And, of course, we had the pleasure on the 23rd of coming up to the Ojai Foundation Center and listening to
Saffron Rossi.
Saffron talking about the feminine aspects, which is kind of what we're going to be talking about in this program.
Yeah, it's actually, I'm excited about the compliment these two offer. And to note, you can also find Saffron's roundtable, her talk on mythosophia.com. But so where Saffron talked about Joseph Campbell, and she actually edited his newest work on the goddess, his only work to ever be exclusively focused on the feminine. And so where her focus in this book of Campbell's focus is the feminine divine, Dara's recently gotten into some work on the feminine heroic. Look at the differences between story structure for male protagonists versus story structure for a feminine protagonist. And this is actually a really important thing because Hollywood has really become saturated with the influence of Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. So Chris Vogler made this really famous. He translated Hero of a Thousand Faces into language for film. Well, where Saffron responded to Hero of a Thousand Faces with Campbell's work on the feminine, Dara's doing a similar thing and responding to all this work out there on the masculine protagonist by giving some real inspired work on the feminine.
And I love that teaching tree. If folks can go to these events, and they can go, I'm sure, to Mythosophia to find links to the events at the Ojai Foundation. But what an incredible tree to sit under and listen to these kinds of talks. We even recorded it, and I'm thinking about, with your permission, maybe even editing that down for one of our programs here, not so much taking the place of one of the monthly broadcasts, but in addition to.
I think that would be great.
Yeah. Well, last month I asked you if you were aware of a mythical place called Shambhala.
Yeah, and I embarrassingly didn't have an immediate answer, although I am somewhat familiar with the story. It's the story of the final incarnation of Vishnu, and it's a Hindu somewhat of a Hindu story that's been adopted by various traditions, Buddhist, but even more recently contemporary traditions like this story, because this story involves the Golden Age, the return of a Golden Age after the end of some kind of almost apocalyptic darkness. The leader, Maitreya, leads a force against the Dark Army and leads humanity into an age, into a Golden Age. So I should have known the myth of Shambhala, but glad to be able to touch on it today.
Well, like me, you can't know it all.
Yeah, we'll prove that every day.
We also talked a little bit about we'll call them the cyborgs. They were referred to as the Borg. I don't know why I didn't put that together when watching that. But nonetheless, you received an email in regards to our conversation about that.
I did. Somebody wanted to suggest that, because we were talking about the Borg in the context of an individualistic society, and the Borg is very much a network or a hive-like society. But the email, the interest was that the Borg are actually run by a head, kind of, you know, might say like a queen of the hive, but she does have personal agendas. And so the question is, well, I don't know if there's so much a question. I just think that to do justice to the email, I think we should talk a little bit about that difference between a pure network-based reality and one that's you might say the difference between socialism and Stalinism.
Yeah. I think we should. I think that would be a very good thing to talk about. And it, again, I think this person is correct. The female character is not brought in until one of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
In the series, there is no central ruler of the hive.
Oh, good point.
It's still just the collective.
Hmm.
There was never any discussion of, or never it was never brought up that there was a single male or female individual who ran the show and had their own personal agenda in that regard.
Interesting.
So you obviously had to carry it forward. And again, I'm not discounting the emailer's mm-hmm. comments. They're very valid in that respect.
Yeah.
Because it's all of the series and the movies, they're all interconnected. And I think that's one of the things that I think they learned from making the very first Star Trek movie called Star Trek, mm-hmm. The Motion Picture. They tried to make an epic. Mm-hmm. They tried to make this standalone kind of event happen and tried to incorporate way too much, I think, into it. And really, the best way to tell the Star Trek story is literally to do it with either individual stories that are tied to other stories mm-hmm. that have already been told
mm-hmm.
and just carry that forward mm-hmm. rather than trying to create some kind of an epic.
Yeah, and on another side of that, the opposite side, one thing I do respect about Star Trek as a myth and as a franchise is that they haven't really gone back and redone the same stories. And even when they have, J.J. Abrams has cleverly made some alternate reality so that they are
right.
different. And I appreciate that for the continuity.
It's funny, too. I know that a lot of people, they tie into Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan. That
mm-hmm.
is like one of the most popular.
Mm-hmm. I guess they kind of redid it. But no, but they made it fair.
They updated it.
Yeah.
They brought them further into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the events that unfold are extraordinary because then they bring new elements that they then are able to carry on in subsequent movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good thing, and I'm just wondering as far as the mythology that we talk about, whether it's Shambhala, whether it's from the Greek or the Roman myths or other cultures' myths. I'm sure that the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Hopis, the Navajo, they have their own myths as well.
Of course.
And I would venture this would be rather interesting, I suppose, to study the comparison between the various mythological stories and their cultures, how similar those stories are.
Yeah.
As far as the main characters, not so much by name, mm-hmm. but obviously by position and attributes.
And here's where the field of mythology shifts into the field of comparative mythology. And I think that there is a lot of – there is both excitement and careful fear when getting into comparative mythology. It's what I am especially into. It's dangerous because you don't ever want to take away the vitality of a story by trying to reduce it to how it relates to another. On the other hand, by looking at these parallels, a lot of times you really can, you can see deeper into their vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, for example, we're here in Southern California, the indigenous Native Americans from here are the Chumash. And the Chumash tell a story of crossing the ocean to get to the Channel Islands, lizard and coyote both, to retrieve a golden flower. Well, the golden object on the western islands on the other side of the ocean, that's a common motif. We have it in Arthur, who goes to Avalon, where the golden apples are, the western island, and this is where he goes to kind of set. And then you also have Hercules, who goes to the western island of he goes across the ocean to mm-hmm. get to Hesperides, where the golden apples are. And so here where you have these stories where they're going as far west to the western continent so that they can get this golden object, which I think one of the main things it represents is the sun, of course, going to the west. But you get all the way to the western island, to the Americas. You get all the way to the west coast, and you find a similar story where they are also going west to the golden object and very much – and this story is also thought to be involved with death, like the others.
Mm-hmm.
So the comparisons are very rich, and there are a lot of overlapping stories. I just do my best to respect the differences as I get into the parallel thing.
We had the opportunity, of course, to meet after the talk on Sunday, and I asked the question in regards to both the archaeological finds as well as the stories themselves. Do you ever run into a problem of the issue of maybe overthinking the
mm-hmm.
myth?
I would suggest that most of the very best students, scholars of myth and folklore, they by definition are overthinking it. But the funny thing is that they also are aware of, often aware of where other people are overthinking it. And there's a bit of a check and balance between different scholars where, you know, one will present this theory and somebody, another scholar will say, oh, you're stretching it. But in this process, you know, the people that think the deepest into these stories, I think they are almost characteristically going to overthink it a bit. But this attitude is also going to carry them into deeper territory than anybody's gone to look at that myth. And it's up to the academic community, sometimes in post, to really situate it properly.
Well, when we come back from our break, we're going to have Dara Marks come in and talk about the feminine aspects of mythology, the feminine heroines or heroic aspects of the myth, and how that has played into our history, as well as how that may play into our future. Mm-hmm. And that'll be very, very interesting. One other question for you, because you are in the process of writing your dissertation. Number one, refresh our listeners as to what it is that you are writing this dissertation for, what your dissertation briefly is about, and how far along are you? And when do you plan on finishing it?
Well, let's get to the last two questions last. The first two, the main thing is the dissertation itself, the topic area is our origin stories of knowledge, particularly in the West. So Prometheus and Pandora, Adam and Eve, and then the birth of philosophy in Greece. These are this is the origin story of knowledge from the scientific point of view, from the Abrahamic point of view, and from the classical point of view. And these three have been the real dominant traditions in the West. That you might say they're the only ones that have ever kind of been the main traditions by a dominant group. So within those three main origin stories, I see their continuation. Of course, the story of science continues past Greece, the story of Adam continues past Adam, and the story of Prometheus continues until at least until Hercules sets him free. And so I look at these stories of knowledge, and I'm looking at a common meta-narrative. And the real simple answer to what that meta-narrative is that I'm looking for, that I'm finding, but you know, I'll admit to that Freudian slip. There is a degree of looking for that has to be admitted. But what I'm finding is an entry into a material world in a materialistic paradigm, and then eventually a departure from that paradigm, a kind of transcendence of, which doesn't mean a complete leaving of appreciation of materialism and materiality, but getting beyond its very limited reality, the limited reality of materialism, to integrate. My argument is wave dynamics, is to integrate elixirs, because I believe elixirs offer an actual behavioral metaphor of union, because waves can unify. Just like right now, you're listening to this on the radio. You could be listening to it from a single speaker, but we could have as many instruments as you possibly imagine, and you could still hear it as a single wave, as a single sound coming from a single speaker. So waves are able to unify and retain their individuality, which is a really big deal. And I think that these great stories are pointing us towards a path to union without compromise of our individuality.
Now, is this going towards a master's?
This is for my PhD.
PhD.
I'm 180 pages in, which is way too many for three chapters. it'll be about 300 pages by the time I'm done, which if it's not next December, I'll be paying more money. So we'll say it's going to be done in December.
So by the time we finish, aside from getting your PhD, through dissertation and the subject accomplished, where will you be in December and in January of 2015, after having written this, what's going on? What's happening to you, and what will be the outcome?
Well, I'm throwing myself at the world as best I can as with my youth, but I think that I'm interested in academics, but the main thing for me is storytelling, but also the reason I got into this particular thesis is because I was really, like many of us, especially 2010 to 2012, really worried about the state of the world. Still am, but really was. And I was trying to get to the bottom of the problems. And eventually, and I looked deeper and deeper and deeper, regressing further and further and further to the bottom of our problems. And I believe that at the very bottom is a metaphor in our minds that we use to build our whole reality around. And that metaphor that's problematic is this metaphor of inherent value, that things are intrinsic, you know, that my ego is intrinsic, that this matter is intrinsic, that something is intrinsically good. Intrinsic is this metaphor of intrinsic qualities, inherent nature, is, I think, without integrating another metaphor of integration and resonance, I think is highly problematic. And so I think actually at the very, very core of our social problems is a commitment to a metaphor, which is at the foundation of a paradigm which sustains materialism and egoism.
So you, through what you're doing, through your dissertation, through your achieving your PhD, are also looking for those new ways of living.
Absolutely.
Just as this radio program is.
Exactly.
And very interesting.
Yep.
Very interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to talking with Daria and having her come in the program, and we're going to do that in just a moment. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Will Lynn, and we will be back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is the Mythosophia, Part 3. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, entertaining the depths of mythology, and we are here with Will Lynn, and our special guest in studio is Dara Marks. And Will, I'm going to allow you to set the stage in terms of introducing Dara to our audience and kick it off as far as we're going to be dealing with the feminine aspects and the feminine heroes within mythology.
Well, first, to set a little context, normally I like to have a lot of books here, but I didn't bring very many because all the books relevant to this one I've lent out one too many times. I had to work to get this one back from Dara. So Dara is a writer and an international script consultant who has devoted the last 20 years to the development of a groundbreaking approach to the theory of the transformational arc and screenplay structure. Her unique method of story analysis has earned her top ratings by Creative Screenwriting Magazine as the best consultant in the business. She's also highly recommended by Dov Siemens and Richard Walter, chair of the UCLA Graduate Screenwriting Program. She's received a PhD in Mythological Studies and Depth Psychology and now teaches at the Pacifica Graduate Institute. She's author of the book, Inside Story, The Power of the Transformational Arc, and she also leads very well supported and wildly raved about 4-day intensive creativity workshop for women called Engaging the Feminine Heroic. So welcome, Dara.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. So let's lead right into a question. As a script consultant, you come from a tradition that includes people like Sid Fields, Robert McKee, Chris Vogler, but you bring something new. In addition to the level of mastery you've achieved in the field of mythological studies, in your most recent work, you've explored some of the differences between stories driven by heroes and heroines. So I want to start out with some questions about myth and film, especially screenwriting, but then I'd like to ask you about your work on what you like to call the feminine heroic. So to start out, can you tell us a bit about what it is to be a script consultant and how you found your way into this business?
Well, like most people, I think in life you start out on one path and then life tends to take you exactly where you need to go. And I started my career trying to break into Hollywood as a writer. Mm-hmm. And to earn money, I started doing story analysis on the side and found that I was very good at it and really enjoyed it. And it was way back in a time where the theories on screenplay story structure in Hollywood were just kind of beginning to form by the people you mentioned, Sid Fields and Linda Seeger and so on. And I was very fortunate to meet Linda Seeger very early on in both of our careers, and she trained me in sort of the fundamentals of story analysis. And so I began doing that on the side. And then, of course, it just became something that was so creatively interesting to me. I kept doing more and more. What happened for my particular journey in this is that the story structure that is traditionally looked at in terms of what is the foundation for a screenplay is pretty much based on the paradigm that we have followed since the time of Aristotle.
Mm-hmm. Poetics.
Poetics. Basic three-act structure. Story has a beginning, middle, and end, and it has mm-hmm. certain elements that you are always looking for in a script. And, you know, it's important to recognize that these elements are archetypal elements in that story is based on, if you will, conflict and conflict resolution. And so the whole notion behind what story structure is very simple. It's if you're going to look at it in terms of three-act structure, it has a beginning where the problem is initiated. It has a middle where it is expanded and more problems enter into the picture, and somewhere along the line it's resolved. And so this is fundamentally accurate. As the more and more I got into story analysis, though, and working with writers, the bigger issue that kept coming up for me is, okay, but where does this come from? Mm-hmm. Because while it may be fundamentally true, as a creative person, if this is all that we know about the elements of story structure, it feels like just the naked supports of a building, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain fundamentals that have to hold up a building or the roof won't, you know, be supported and the walls will fall in on us. But it also, so it has the feeling of A, being a formula instead of an mm-hmm. authentic form. Mm-hmm. And it also feels, even though it isn't, it feels like decisions you make based on this architecture feel like they are artificially imposed on the story.
Right.
And
like you're filling out a form.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And certainly that is anathema to how most creative people mm-hmm. want to look at the process. And so what my work kept opening up for me is, yes, that architecture is true. Those elements do exist mm-hmm. in a story. But there are more elements that exist in a story that run as companion to that, primarily that there is an interior structure to a story that gives us the movement of character throughout. Mm-hmm. And the reason that this is so powerful is not just because it's more information. It's because it more closely mimics the human experience. In our human lives, at any given moment, this moment, we are operating always on two levels. We live in an external world where life is materialized, and we live in an internal world where we are in constant reaction and in relationship to that outer world. So that at any given moment, whatever is going on in the material world, and where there are more than two people gathered, there are more than two perceptions of exactly what is going on. And so if story structure is to really be helpful for writers to get into the interior realm and to not look at these sort of external pillars of story that move story forward as simply feeling artificially imposed, we can dive into the inner realm of the story mm-hmm. by understanding how the inner movement of character is processed.
And I've pulled up a couple quotes on
if you mind,
from your book, from Inside Story. And I think, actually, because this is, to me, before we get into the feminine stuff, mm-hmm. really the most compelling thing about your work is, I mean, you might even replace the words, the term story structure with character narrative for the way that you mm-hmm. talk about things. It's so internal. Mm-hmm. So you say, the quest for wholeness, for connection to all the undiscovered parts of our true nature, which includes our relationship with nature itself, is the model around this theory of the transformational arc is formed. It embraces the principle that any living thing that isn't growing and evolving can only be moving towards decay and death, that we are either moving towards life or away from it, is the heart of the human drama. To stand up and fight through the conflicts, confrontations, and disappointments we all encounter is the heroic challenge. To run away, disregard, dismiss, or avoid these challenges isn't merely benign or cowardly, it's tragic. It destroys the opportunity to grow and evolve. Ultimately, this path leads only to the death of hopes, dreams, ambitions, love, and the form of interconnectedness. And that's not the quote I was looking for. I had one pulled up.
Well,
on
I can jump on that one for a second.
Please
here
do.
While you're looking.
Yeah.
Because to me, this opens up a much bigger conversation of mm-hmm. what is narrative at all.
Mm-hmm.
That we tend to think of narrative simply as an entertainment venue. Something, whether it's fairy tale, folk tale, movies, plays, novels, whatever it is, video games, that there is that it is something where we do when we put our mind at rest. And I think that if you are really want to open this up in a bigger way to see what power it holds, recognize that the way that we think, the way that we process life, the way that our human psyche works is completely narratively. That we and the evidence of that is very simple, that the moment that we are living in, the actual now time, is nothing more than a few seconds. And everything past those few seconds is memory. And what is memory but a narrative? And so it tells us that we are wired narratively. We are wired to know the world through narrative, through storytelling. And some of it's very sophisticated, all the way into the land of mythology. And some of it is very simple. Hi, honey, how was your day? But it's all narrative. And this informs who we are and how we live. And I would even take that argument a step further to say that in the same way that the sexual act is...
I was hoping we were going to talk about this. Please do. This is brilliant.
This is a little pet theory of mine that I have no proof of whatsoever. But in the same way that we are wired biologically to enjoy the sexual act so that we will procreate the species, I believe that we are wired narratively... And we love to tell stories, and we actually get those endorphins out of storytelling so that we will propagate the human psyche.
It's funny you say that, because anybody in my business is a storyteller.
Of course.
I am accused of that all the time. I love to tell stories, whether they're true or not. I try not to embellish, but
good stories.
I want you to continue, but I wanted to ask a sidebar question in regards to screenplay writing. I had heard years ago that there are only 51 or 52 formula storylines in either movies or television, and that certainly it can deviate from any one of those, but there are 51 like basic storylines. Does that sound familiar at all?
It sounds familiar. Comments like that always make me really nervous in terms of, you know, I work with writers, artists, and the whole world has to be available, so that anything that sounds constricting makes me nervous. However, I'm going to take another side of that argument, because the whole reason for the study of myth, especially as we look at it at Pacifica Graduate Institute, we are looking at the archetypal values and principles that are emerging in story. In other words, I can bring both conversations back together here, that if story is, as I said, something that is so ubiquitous that it is the very air we breathe, okay? And if it serves the highest function of telling us how to live. In other words, when I said earlier that we are wired toward toward narrative, and that it is deceptive in its, you know, it makes it enjoyable so that we tell our stories. The purpose of it, for me, it seems that it carries information about how to live. That if you think about your own lives, how do you know anything? How do you know anything?
Are we going to do this?
Well, no, wait a minute. I would even argue that mathematics is narrative.
Okay.
That just a bunch of random information is nothing that has connective fiber to it from which you can make the next assumption. And so that it is a narrative in that it is a problem looking for solution. Okay, and that's the narrative form. And so I often in my talks refer to story as the human instruction manual, that it's there to serve as guide. Okay. So now to go circle back around to the comment that you brought up, if it is carrying this valuable information about how to live, then you can also look at stories and say, well, the stories that are told the most must have the most information. The more a story is told, the more it is telling our story, right? And this is why we study myth, that we can say that if you look at stories that take us all the way back to antiquity, not every story out of antiquity survived, mm-hmm. but the ones that are survive carry meaning.
Survivey,
yes. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, think about it. If you have something important to tell somebody, you can tick off 5 points of what's important, or you can encapsulate it in a story. Which one of those do you think is going to survive
They've
millennium?
Shown. You remember more information when it's put in a
that's
story.
That's right. Yep. And think about it surviving for millennium. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, if then mythologies are, in effect, the deepest, perhaps, part of the human instruction manual. Mm-hmm. They have been told so deeply for so long that once you open them up and sort of deconstruct their meaning, there it is. So going back to this notion that there are only a handful of stories, we can also look at that through an archetypal lens to say that at this level, what archetype really means, it is consistent patterns of human experience. And to follow that, I will say that you can add to that that no one invents what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. We are all the same except in the detail.
Okay, I'm all about defining terms.
And now, well, I just want to put the final
okay, go ahead.
Piece on that. So now we look at how many stories are there to tell.
Right.
Well, there are as many stories to tell as there are aspects of the human experience, and that probably is somewhat finite. Mm-hmm. But it's in the detail that it feels infinite.
Infinite,
so that
right.
was a very long mm-hmm. way around to answer
very
your
good,
question.
Very good. And so let me ask you, so what is the difference between, as you've defined, archetype mm-hmm. and stereotype? Because it seems like they might be very, very similar.
An important question for the show in general. So.
Because now we're talk about, and that has to do
with... You look at what a stereotype is without substance,
yeah.
right? However, images do carry substance, and it's interesting because when I work with writers on their material, one of the things I delve into quite deeply is the theme, what a story mm-hmm. is really about. In other mm-hmm. words, what a story is trying to say to you and through you. And in order to get to that, you have to start – I always advise writers, don't try and dive into the deep end. Start in the mm-hmm. shallow end. Start with what is on the surface. So what is on the surface may be, well, this is a love story. So my theme is love. Hmm. And I remind writers that love is not a theme, all right? Love is the subject of a theme. It's what you have to say about love that gives its meaning. Mm-hmm. So when I'm working with writers and they reach a point of even something that sounds stereotypical or it sounds like a platitude or sounds cliche, I actually welcome it. Mm-hmm. Not because this is where I want the story to stop, but sometimes it represents the portal through which we can look to find more. So when something is stereotyped, it just means that it is unfinished, it is unopened.
Mm-hmm.
And if you open it, there can be so much more meaning and power to it because, I mean, we all know that, I mean, where do stereotypes come from? But often from something much deeper, they mm-hmm. just get, they get stuck at a very fixed level. And as an artist, of course, you don't want to get stuck at a fixed level. But I also suggest don't avoid it. I mean, sometimes artists work so hard to not be obvious or to not be cliche that they miss the juice of what is sitting right in front of them.
They're keeping themselves from being authentic.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And because like in a courtroom, when one of the participants opens the door to a topic, the other is allowed then to pursue it. Mm-hmm. You open the door as far as sexual relationships between men and women.
Yeah.
The stereotypical stereotype between men and women in a sexual relationship is men are like microwaves and women are like crockpots. I mean, that's the stereotype.
Okay.
Okay. But let's.
I think you just birthed a new stereotype.
No. That's what I am aware of.
It
goes back a long, long way.
Okay.
But in terms of this whole aspect of the feminine heroines and that aspect of mythology, some of the stories that come to mind are those of women in the past who basically you know, weren't like Xena, the warrior princess, mm-hmm. or Wonder Woman. Mm-hmm. They were like women who just held their own mm-hmm. and held the family together, for example. Maybe someone like, who's the gal that was burned at the stake?
Joan of Arc.
Joan of Arc, mm-hmm. thank you. Mm-hmm. And then I think of even some of the biblical characters, even mm-hmm. Mary and Mary Magdalene, for example, who, mm-hmm. By all accounts, from what I have been able to discern, actually was not a prostitute and was right. actually the first disciple mm-hmm. as far as some of the non-canonical historical evidence that, mm-hmm. that I've seen. So that to me says that we have defined the word, and this kind of goes back to my issue of definitions, in terms of being more precise about our language, but somehow that doesn't seem to help, because if you read Shakespeare versus, say, James Joyce versus, say, Tom Sawyer or Mark Twain, mm-hmm. They're using different words maybe to describe the same thing. So unless you have a point of reference, I have to really listen hard to Shakespeare to get the meaning. I've got to listen to all of the words in a collective manner. I can't just take the one word because I don't know what that one word means. Mm-hmm. I need the other words wrapped around it to make context
you
for
me. You
need
both.
So let's talk about that in terms of these stories. I mean, Will, you made the comment that people remember mm-hmm. a story longer than they do the abbreviated mm-hmm. version or the abridged version.
And more information in it, yeah.
Exactly. So how is that possible when the potential is that there's so much that can be lost, say, even in translation?
Mm-hmm.
Not just in terms of someone who has a 150,000-word vocabulary versus someone who has a 40,
uh-huh.
and from language to language. I know that's a big,
yep.
big
okay,
thing there, but
there's so much to pick from there.
Yeah. Well, how about this? Let's say,
I do have an interesting comment on that, because you just made me think about the idea of you know, so humanity is going through so many enormous shifts right now, mm-hmm. and I don't think the influence of cinema and the moving image is couldn't possibly, I mean, it is possibly one of the greatest advances. That's where the sentence was going. I said it backwards. But it because it seems to me, when you say how, you know, that the words can, what words form a container kind of, that can continue to move,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Notice that cinema, for the most part, or anything with a moving picture, is far more inclusive than exclusive. It doesn't simply rely on words. It relies on image.
You see mm-hmm. everything on this in this thing. Yeah,
right. And, mm-hmm. and a powerful image, you know, I mean, this is where you get into really great filmmaking, is that a powerful image can tell a whole story in mm-hmm. a simple image. In other words, before the story.
Right.
There is something, I always remind writers that the nature of all conflict is that something is out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And so an image can simply capture the imbalance that we feel, and it drops down into a much mm-hmm. deeper level than all the words in the world could make.
And that deeper level is almost more enduring than any word could ever be.
Yeah.
And I will give you a prime example of a modern-day film that achieved that. I walked in the middle of this particular film. There isn't one word spoken. There's sound, there's music. Not one word is spoken. From the time I walked into the end, I felt that imbalance, mm-hmm. that uneasiness, and I'm watching this individual struggle, and it was the movie All Is Lost uh-huh. with Robert Redford.
Mm.
And it wasn't until after the movie was over, my wife was saying, oh, no, there's no dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow. And mm-hmm. it was, for me, it was very profound to watch mm-hmm. the events unfold. And again, it goes mm-hmm. back to what you talked about, what a story contains, a beginning, a middle, and an end.
And it makes it a lot more inward for a story, right? When he's not talking, when he's not extroverting, you're going into his head even
more. If you could have a woman in a certain manner, mm-hmm. really sometimes, mm-hmm. you carries herself, her inflection, mm-hmm. How condensed the words are, how mm-hmm. that's all image making as well, you know?
Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of time, too, where, and I think this is a new technique, maybe in the last 15 or 20 years, and then they come back to the present again. And it's a little disconcerting if you're not aware that that's what they're doing. But that's obviously the now was all that was important.
Well, these are all just devices, and there are many ways to tell a story, and sometimes being able to go back in time lands the story in a big way. You know, it's just a different type of device.
So who are the heroes and heroines, or I should say, who are the heroines that we want to look to in our discussion of mythology?
So if Campbell's getting all of his hero's journey from all these heroes, who should we be inspired by looking for heroines?
Well, my approach actually goes a little bit in a different direction.
Okay.
That because, you know, we get very sort of caught up in sometimes looking at the feminine or as being strictly a female aspect of who we are.
Thanks for starting.
And so I really want to separate those two things out because we have these aspects that live inside us, and I think that this is what is not very well understood, and it is such a powerful tool for creative people, but also just for understanding ourselves and our lives better, that the masculine side of our nature, not the male side, but the masculine side, is the part of us that aspires, that especially in the outer physical world. So to be all that you can be, to aim at the stars, to go out, to get up every day and do your best, and we build lives, we build families. This is the part of us that has aspiration, and you can say that the highest apex of the masculine drive is the drive towards spirit, to be all that we can be, to aim at the highest Godhead.
To be spirited,
right? To be spirited, but to aim at the highest Godhead, whatever that may be.
Infinite ambition,
right. And you can see the essentialness of that that's what builds civilizations and builds a world and makes our world tangible and allows us to be individual and to strive and go after things. However, what doesn't get as much attention is the feminine side of our nature, which is the part that takes us inward and into our inner realms, the deepest point of which we could say is soul. Okay, so to differentiate in that way, I think it can be helpful because we understand that both of these principles are very, very important to us. We need to strive. We need to go out into the world and do our best. However, the feminine realm, which is the inner realm, is the part of us that makes meaning, that puts value to something. And so it is the part of us that deals with often the fear, the disappointment, the sense of loss and longing, and sort of oftentimes the unwanted emotions that we need to sort of suppress in order to go out into the world and strive. And so it's a funny split. And so my work with what I term the feminine heroic is not just aimed at women or making super Xena women characters. It's about making both masculine, male and female characters more whole, that we need this. And, you know, I think there is a very interesting thing that you can see in the movies, so many of the films that we have out today, because a lot of our films are, when they are dealing with young people, often are films that focus on a certain kind of striving that we need earlier in life. And we can only get there if we do a big push into life that means suppressing a lot of emotions to get movement going. However, when you look at films that, and so that would be like films like Social Network, The Social Network, okay? And if you notice, he even offends women. And there's one woman in particular. So you can see that one of the sort of principles that is taking place comes in this particular aspect of the feminine, comes right out of mythology, if I can share that with you, because it sort of explains why this is so and what is on the other side of it. The myths around the Trojan Wars evolve out of a what is often referred to as the Decision of Paris, where the gods and goddesses are having a big celebration, and Eris, the goddess of strife, is not involved. So she throws a golden apple into the party, and on the apple it says, "For the fairest." And so there is a lot of fighting over the apple, like who amongst the great goddesses is deserving of this particular apple. Well, the gods are there, and they say, "I'm not touching this one." So they take this.
It looks like a mortal,
right? So they make a mortal make this decision. So they take this shepherd named Paris, and they say, "You decide." And he also says, "Thank you, no." Uh-huh. But they force him to make the decision, and part of the decision is he can't split the apple; he has to give it to one of them. And so the goddesses of power and wealth and all of this sort of stuff vie for his attention, along with Aphrodite, who says, "I will give you the most beautiful." And being a young man, he opts for Aphrodite, and she gives him Helen of Troy. And so the great war is started, and as a result of that war, all the Greeks, because once Helen is stolen and taken to Troy, now the Greeks are going to go to war.
They had made a commitment that marriage was ever broken, they would back it up.
Right. And,
thanks,
and
Odysseus.
And they're going to war to get Helen back. And so I always wonder if that was where the phrase go to Helen back.
Helen back.
Anyway, so they want to go to war, and they all gather around Agamemnon, the great Greek king, and they're all ready to go, and all their ships and all their men and everybody is ready, and they're in the harbor, and they can't get out because there's no wind. There is no wind, and they wait and they wait, and there's no wind, and life is dissipating here. So a seer comes along and says, "Well, if you want to get out of the harbor, you have to make a great sacrifice." So Agamemnon says, "Great, get me a bull. I'll sacrifice my bull." And he says, "No, it's your daughter, Iphigenia, who needs to be sacrificed." And he says, "Thank you, no." But no wind. Eventually, he says, "Well, I have to do this." So he sacrifices his daughter, and the wind picks up. They go to war, and of course, the rest is history. Well, if you look at what that particular myth is telling us, it tells us a lot about who we are, especially when we are younger, that first of all, we have to make choices on what aspect of the self we're going to give attention to. Mm-hmm. And some of us opt for, we're good at sports, or we're good at mathematics, or we're the most beautiful, or whatever. We put our attention towards that thing. And inevitably, what happens in all of our lives as we grow and mature is that we are more than that one thing. And so that other aspects of ourselves will eventually go to war to get our attention. This is often where you see a lot of strife occurring, let's say around the late 20s and 30s, that there is more to us than just this. And so this starts to point attention toward, you know, where great tragedy can lie if we can't be more than that.
And a lot of good stories start right there.
Right. And then the other part of the myth also tells us that in order to get movement in life, we need wind behind our sails. That is an archetypal principle. We have to get some wind behind our sails.
And in Greece, it's the same word as soul.
Something is out of balance. You're going to initiate this imbalance because you cannot carry fear and striving in equal measure if you're trying to launch a life. However, there is also another principle. There is Agamemnon comes home. His wife greets him with
thanks, Clytemnestra,
and demanded. So this is how a deeper look at the feminine heroic is looking at aspects of both the masculine and the feminine. And just to add on to this, this is young, you know, how we are when we are young, and also when we are young into an endeavor. That even if we're in our 50s, but we're starting a new endeavor, we need that wind behind ourselves. We need that energy. You know, we have to suppress some of the fear and anxiety in order to make something new. However, if you look at also what the masculine aspect of striving and its aim at the apex of spirit to be all that you can be, it also tells us that we are inevitably opening ourselves up for some kind of crisis,
mm-hmm.
because we are not the Godhead. We cannot be all there is to be.
We are
That's right. That there are there are limitations in the mortal human realm, and when those hit, they often lead us to existential crisis. You know, mm-hmm. I thought if I was going to be if I had $1 million by the time I was 30, then I would be happy.
Uh-huh.
Well, I have $1 million and I'm still not happy, or mm-hmm. I never made it to $1 million, so I must be worth less.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter which way you go with this argument, you're not going to win it. And so the other aspect of the feminine in terms of making meaning is that it fortunately, when we hit these crises, what do? You know, the crisis can come along in terms of the loss of a particular career or job we thought we had to have in order to be successful. It can be the breakup of a marriage. It can be an unexpected loss of a loved one. Mm-hmm. It can be so many things that affect us. And where do we go when these crises hit? It's only these crises that tend to then open us up and force us inward.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is through this balance between striving to be everything but with mortal limitations, and those limitations, thank God,
mm-hmm.
create you know, woundings that mm-hmm. open us up into the inner world and into the inner realm. So this is when I was coming across all of this, part of my reaction to it, because I do work with creative people and, you know, I do creative work myself, is how creatively stimulating this is
mm-hmm.
to suddenly have our look at the human experience opened up in this way, where we too are part of these patternings, and to be able to say, oh my God, there I am. And so this is why I designed, and with my partner Deb Norton, we have designed these creative retreats.
Yeah, real quick, where tell we us go. About those.
Well, it's an opportunity to really explore this whole archetypal terrain. I usually tell the mythic stories, and that leads to discussions and the sharing of our own experiences like this. Because I'm sure if I said to either of you, when did you, you know, have you hit a crisis of faith? We'd have great things to talk about, you know, and how that in the time of going through it, it may have been misery. But what came out on the other side is inevitably the meeting of a greater piece of yourself, mm-hmm. because that's how that is at the core of the human story, is that that stories, as I said to you, are the human instruction manual. And at its very, very basic, what stories instruct us on is that our conflicts and problems mm-hmm. In life mm-hmm. are doable. They may not take us where we think they should go, but they will take us somewhere. That the only true tragedy in life is quitting, not failing. Mm. You know, and so we see this as part of the pattern. And so that's what we're able to do in the retreats is that tell the stories, open them up, open it to a dialogue, and then Deb masterfully takes us through some wonderful exercises that drops us right down into this before you even know you've gotten there. And the work coming out of this is really unbelievable.
And this is in Montecito. Mm-hmm. And on what days? I'm looking it up.
Okay, thank you. I think it's the I know it's the middle of June. It's the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I think it's the 12th through the 15th.
I think that's right. It is the... and you can go to daramarks.com for information on her book and for this. And the dates are, the 12th through the 15th of June in Montecito. So you're talking about a little bit about story as a way to tell us about how to live life. And is a bit of a code or guidebook on how to live. And it's also a legacy of what has happened. And I think one of the most interesting things about where those two points come together is that the most important legacy many of us want to leave is the lessons that we've learned and guidance for the next people. And so we had Dennis Slattery on here, and he talked a lot about memory and how important memory is to myth, and how important stories are as perpetuators, not just of memory for purpose, but memory just to remember each other and know ourselves. And I think it's beautiful when those two come together, and the most important memories we want people to remember of us are the way we helped others and the lessons we have that can.
You know, but I will add to that, too, that also we'd like it to all be flowers and sunshine and roses, and wasn't I a kind, wonderful person? But, you know, the things that also leave an indelible mark on the world are often also our failures, that there is so much to be gained by examining where we didn't make it, and either, A, how we got to the other side anyway, and what it opened up on the other side. Because, you know, I mean, all of us certainly have experienced this idea that if all my greatest dreams came true, how limited my world would be compared to, you know, what the surprises that are out there, okay? But it, also the tragedy, because tragedy is a very powerful way of also expressing the human journey. What happens to us naturally in story is an identification with the protagonist in a story. As perception. They make choices, we make choices. Not necessarily the same. We often have a much greater perspective on the story than the actual protagonist does. We can see more. And so, you know, you find yourself sitting in a movie going, oh, just kiss her, you fool, or, you know, don't do that, don't go there. But when a character makes tragic decisions, we don't say, oh, I want to be like that.
Right.
We say, oh, don't be like that.
But we value the character the same. Yeah.
That's right. So, you know, we leave a legacy whether we do good or bad.
Yeah.
You know? And it is telling us, go there or don't go there. That's just the
totally.
Story. Yes.
And a lot of times the protagonist isn't an individual. Sometimes it's just the circumstance that the individual is in, the event that's taking place. And so now you just have the one-on-one self versus, you know, Mother Nature per se, or what have you, and I find that interesting as well. We're talking with Dara Marks, and I'm here with Will Lynn, and this is Tell Me Your Story: New Paradigms for a New World, Mythosophia, and we're here every once a month at the end of every month, and we're going to be here for the next. I believe this is the third program, so we've got nine to go,
and the next one is going to be with Zaman Stanazai on the mythology of Eden. And Zaman writes for the Huffington Post and is a professor of mythology. So that'll be wonderful.
I was going to say, that's going to be very interesting. Yeah. I guess I'm going to have to go back and reread Genesis.
Luckily, those are just a few pages on Eden.
Let me ask, before we wrap up our program here, Dara, and I do put this, I don't know that I've put this to the last couple of program guests that we've had.
You did.
Who is Dara Marks?
Okay. Interesting question.
I was just as blindsided as you when I did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, all right. I'm usually pretty good at this. I'm just, like the rest of us, kind of engaging in the journey in life, trying to stay in the flow of things, seeing where it will take me. You know, as I said, like many people, I started out thinking my life was going to go in one direction. And sometimes if you surrender to where the river of life is taking you, there are wonderful surprises there. So I guess I can say I'm someone who is constantly amazed and surprised by all the potential that is out there in this world.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Well, some really exciting things actually have opened up. As Will mentioned, I teach at Pacifica and am still very engaged with the work, the wonderful work that is being done at Pacifica in all fields of therapeutic fields and mythological studies and archetypal theory and all of that is happening. And My day-to-day work is as a script consultant. So I work freelance, but I work with writers all around the world on their scripts and producers and directors and things that are movies that are being made. because of the kind of work that I do and my focus on the inner story, I really have been involved in kind of a crusade to hopefully get the message out to filmmakers that there is a better way to tell our stories, that you see all, you know, we all go to movies and we see how limited some of these movies are, that they have a great idea, but there is no inner exploration. And this is not just limited to a certain genre like action films that's all that are all action. There are love stories that tell us nothing about the nature of love. There are socially relevant movies that only wag their finger and tell us how bad those people were, but they don't tell us what the human spirit needs to transcend the situations we're in life. And so there is a lot of complexity and depth to what it means to tell a great story. And unfortunately, our film industry has not really invested very much in trying to open up and understand the deep nature of story. I mean, you know, I think the industry knows a whole lot more about how to set off a magnificent explosive than about how to open up the human heart. And so I have been working with Pacifica and with an organization in Hollywood called GATE, which is the Global Alliance for Transformational Entertainment. And we are actually trying to put together a hopefully, then this is all, this unfortunately isn't going to start anytime soon, but we are in the beginning phases of putting together a certificate program to train writers, producers, directors, and story analysts on how to write and create deeper, more meaningful narratives. Because if we can do this, we're going to have that human instruction manual we're putting out there every day is going to really change. It'll change the world, because right now the stories we're telling are so limited. They're just limited to one side of what we are, and it's all about striving, and they're not telling us about how to access the our inner life.
Then I would encourage you and others to listen in on the May 25th. My guest will be Brent Marchant, and he's written a book, his second book. It's called Consciously Created Cinema. And it's dealing with those films that have latched onto or are encapsulating the aspects of the law of attraction and then some, and some movies I've seen that are just spectacular in their message, in their meaning, as well as in their visual effects. And so that'll be a fun program. Final question for you.
Yes.
Who inspires you?
Oh, my goodness. I have to tell you that what honestly inspires me are all the creative people I work with, that every time I encounter a film, whether I'm working on a script with a particular writer, or I've seen a movie, or I read a story, or someone just tells me a story, they're like fingerprints. Everyone is so unique. And honestly, I really get my inspiration by seeing more and more of the magnitude and the magnificence of the human story. And it makes me an optimist. It makes me feel very much that in spite of ourselves, we're just working this out, and we're headed someplace really powerful.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today and sharing this special series that Will has actually brought to us. And this is something that when we first talked about this idea back in October, November of 2013, I jumped at the chance because I thought, well, this is right up my alley, especially when we did a program on Prometheus, who I would
dub. She ends her book with Prometheus, by the way.
Oh, great.
But anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
Who is, of course, the god who brings about, of course, the two changes in humanity. One is fire and the other is higher consciousness. And that's what we're about here, is trying to raise the consciousness to find the new ways of living that work for everyone, not just for a select few. And we want everyone to come on board. However, there is a condition. You have to let go of the old ways of thinking, because it won't work any other way. So thank you so much for joining us.
It was really a pleasure. Thank you both.
Will, thank you for bringing Dara to us, and we look forward to next week. Tell us again who's going to be our guest next week.
Zaman Stanazai is a scholar of Islamic studies and truly a mystic himself, and he'll be talking about the mythology of Eden.
Great. Looking forward to that. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, Mythosophia, and we will be back next month, end of the month, following Brent. Oh, actually, it'll be May 25th is when Brent Marchand is going to be on, but we'll be back in April, end of April, with another edition of Mythosophia. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story. Until next time, love to Lal.